With over 16 years of experience in the classroom, Star is an author, blogger, and speaker committed to changing the way we do assessment nationally and globally. You can connect with her work at mssaxteen.com and follow her on X at mssaxteen. Star, thank you so much for coming on the show today. Are you ready to light it up?
I sure am going to try.
Well, thank you so much for joining me, Star. I'm a little bit awestruck because I've been waiting for this for a long, long time and following your work, and I'm certainly a fan. So I can't wait to dig into some of the questions we've got here today. But before we get into your beliefs about student agency and assessment, I want to dig into your story just a little bit. Okay. Please share with us about a low moment or an experience of adversity that you faced somewhere in your teaching or education journey and describe how you overcame it.
Oh, wow. There's a lot to kind of choose from. In the beginning, and I could do a beginning and an end from when I was working in the, you know, with schools specifically. In the beginning, when I first started teaching, I think some of the challenges I faced as a young teacher who didn't have student teaching in a predominantly minority school where I was the only white person in the room, there was a lot of learning to do about how best to serve the kiddos that I worked with when I had such a limited understanding of what it even meant to be a teacher at that point. And I think some of the things that really made me successful, despite my huge gaps, were my ability to connect with the kids in a meaningful way, ask a lot of questions, and stay curious about who they were as people so that they could help me better serve them. And although I might not known a lick about what kind of teaching strategies I was going to be using or even what the best content was to teach them at that time, my relationship with them was really the thing that kept me connected. And as I continued to grow in my career, after being in the classroom for 16 years and then going into district leadership after that, I had hoped that I would be able to reach more classrooms by being in that leadership role and helping folks in that space. And one of the challenges for me really as a leader was that, you know, you get hired for a reason, you think, right? Like they tell you you're background, your passions, mine specifically with making kids a part of the assessment process, really trying to diminish the use of grades in classrooms, became an impediment for me as a leader. And the adversity that I felt coming in as a new leader in a new system who had ideas about being a different kind of leader than the one that I had always worked with. Like I wanted to be the leader who I always wanted and never had. And so I thought I was going to have the flexibility really to do as many classroom visits as I wanted to do, to co-teach with my teachers, to model stuff, like all the things. Like if I was going to ask my teachers to try a strategy they had never tried before, I was going to have to be the person to demonstrate it for them, go in their room as an extra pair of eyes without any evaluative lens and just sort of support them. And what I learned really quickly is that leadership is maybe 40% that, and then 60% of a lot of things that I don't want to spend my time doing, like politics and playing a game that I don't think is a good use of my time and really squashing my ideas about things. Like, you know, when you're sitting around a table of leaders and they ask you, does anyone have an idea about that? And you share openly the first couple of times because you think they really want to hear, only to be chastised later because they don't really want to hear. It was eye-opening. And I think what I learned about myself in that two-year time period is that maybe I could do better work in different spaces where I'm kind of above the politics of what's going on, which is why consulting, like implementation consulting, I like to think of it job embedded, where I'm not just inspiring people, but I'm actually getting my hands dirty, being in classrooms with them, helping them throughout the implementation process. That was my solution. You know, let me help these folks and stay out of the personal politics of what's happening in the buildings and just do the work.
Makes a ton of sense, Star. Thank you so much for sharing that. And I know we're going to come back to that entrepreneurial and independent approach to changing education a little bit later in this conversation. And I'm looking forward to that a lot. Well, I want to congratulate you on student-led assessment, promoting agency and achievement through portfolios and conferences. What is one thing that teachers and schools need to know about these two things, portfolios and conferences? I know there's so much here. There's a book's worth. But if you could share one takeaway for schools that maybe they are missing right now, what comes to mind?
So if you want to get student buy-in and you want students to take pride and ownership in their work, portfolios are the best way for them to be able to actually see their growth over time, because they actually have evidence of where they started and where they're going, and they have this opportunity to compare the early learning with the later learning. And it teaches them to set goals, really track their progress in really meaningful ways. And then once they have that body of knowledge about themselves as learners, they're able to have these really excellent conferences where a lot of the things that we don't see visibly in their learning can become visible in the conversation. So we give them the vocabulary to talk about their learning, set goals, and do all the things, reflect, and then help us understand their process. And the book really goes into detail about how we set up cultures to do these kinds of things, and then also what it looks like throughout a school year, especially if no one else in your system is doing this with you, how you can really get kids to do this even in one classroom. This does not have to be a school-wide effort, although a school-wide effort is preferable.
So great. And I know we're going to come back to a couple of your titles in this conversation. The one on the far left is the one we were just discussing, student-led assessment. Again, promoting agency and achievement through portfolios and conferences. Who doesn't want to see more agency and achievement for our learners? Thank you so much and best of luck. I know you're presenting on that very topic this afternoon. Well, Star, I want to get into one of your older titles. You've written there in Hacking Assessment, I believe, that it isn't the grade, but the conversation that communicates the learning. And I think that's so profound. I titled this conversation with that quote. Why is it important for teachers to give meaningful feedback? And what does that look like? I mean, maybe we need to contrast it against feedback that is not meaningful. I'm not sure. But how do we start on this?
Well, what isn't meaningful is a grade. A grade can mean a million different things. And when it's taken out of context, it really does mean nothing. And what's crazy is when you ask students how they're doing in something, they're probably going to skip to the last test or the last project and the grade they got, but they can't even tell you what the content was that they learned in that space. So when we remove the grades and we give kids really directed strategic feedback, which should be aligned to their goals that they set, that's really where the learning happens, because that's where the differentiation happens. And that's where all of the leaning into what kids know and can do really happens. And feedback can look so many different ways. It could be writing, like I could read something kids wrote, provide really specific validation or constructive feedback that's going to align with the criteria of what we're working on. Or I could have a conversation with them if they have a question about something, and then I'm able to have that dialogue that helps them get what they need to be successful. And when we come back to agency with that too, it's not about us only giving them feedback, but them using the feedback and holding them accountable for using the feedback that they're getting. I'm sure too many teachers would be like, I spend 40 minutes writing all over these papers, providing feedback, and then kids throw it out as soon as they get it. And my suggestion with that would be is remove the grade and expect them to revise, or at least expect them to take the feedback, read it, and do something with it. Because if you're going to spend all that time to help them improve, then they need time to improve. Right. And putting it on the summative piece all the way at the end is almost, it's antithetical to the things we're trying to do with it. I don't know that putting constructive feedback on a summative piece is really going to get you the gains you want.
Yeah, it's all about taking that next step for students, right? What is my next step of growth? And simply, I mean, you sort of drew a picture for me of handing back writing feedback, and I want to go there next. But, you know, I think back to some of my older practices. If I cover an essay with markups, but there's no action to follow, then it's not very valuable for the student. And I think that's been a hang up for many teachers. So let's talk a little bit more about writing specifically. You also wrote that it wasn't until I moved from a numbered rubric, to a feedback-only form that I saw drastic improvement in student writing. So you described it a little bit, you touched on it, but take us a little bit deeper when it comes to only offering feedback on writing. What does that look like?
So basically, I think right now I've seen teachers who grade drafts of work. And even when you're using a rubric 5-4-3-2-1, 4-3-2-1, you know, those numbers become the focus of what the learning is about. They're trained into it, honestly. That's a systemic training of learned behaviors that most systems put into kids. By the time they're in third grade and taking standardized tests, they become accustomed to looking for those kinds of cues. And what I would really encourage folks to do is really shift away from that, because if we want kids to make the growth that we know they can, we need to provide exemplars. We need to give really descriptive feedback that also has action steps. And it just can't be strategies that you're randomly putting on the paper. You have to teach them how to use the strategies and then work with them. Not every strategy is going to work for every learner. So just being aware of which ones tend to work for which kids and direct them in this way until they have a robust toolbox. And then they can start making those choices on their own without you having to be the one to say, you know, you should try this. Instead, they now have three or four that they know work in different situations, and you could give them the freedom to make those choices themselves. So long as they've found something that works, I think that's the only thing that really matters. Promoting one right way is going to be the worst way to get kids to actually move forward, because you'll always have at least one kid in the room who that one way you're promoting is definitely not going to work for.
Yeah. Love the agency there. Well, thank you for joining us, Teachers on Fire. If you're getting value from this conversation, give this video a like and say hello in the comments. Star, you've said that school is a power game that systematically disenfranchises young people. And I'm wondering, for those who maybe are new to the grades conversation, maybe they're coming from a heavy point system, let us know in short. And again, this is something that I know you could talk for hours on, but how have grades and points been used in ways that disenfranchise students?
This is such a heavy, it's so heavy when you think about these kinds of things, because grades, there's a whole history behind how grades became a part of our system. I certainly won't go into that now, but there's lots of research out there that you could certainly look into. Grades are really a power tool, right? I hate to say it, but And I was guilty of it myself in the beginning of my career. We use grades to control kids, really. Whether we're adding points for extra credit, taking points away for lateness, taking points off for not following directions, all of those things have nothing to do with learning. They're more compliance measures. And I think a lot of times, once kids sort of fall into a category of not being a good student for whatever reason, low grades, whatever, they start to feel like their learning isn't about them. You get one really low score, which is followed by another, and then you start to see these students disconnecting, not wanting to take ownership of things that they don't feel their teachers are listening to them. And I think that we worry so much about kids getting what they need. And I think teachers are well-meaning. I don't think that this is really an intentional thing anybody does. It's just what we know and what's been done to us. Right. But the competitive nature of grading and putting kids against each other to get those high spots creates a culture that does not breed ownership and agency. It does the opposite, unfortunately, because you have a small group of kids who are always going to be at the top, hungry to get what they need to do to get to where they're going. And I think that those kids who are super type A assertive will control a learning space if you let them. And then you have another whole room full of kids who aren't engaging because they know to keep quiet and let those kids do their thing. And that could be disenfranchising if you think about it, if you're not one of those assertive kids who isn't going to fight for the airtime.
Thank you so much, Safa, for joining us on LinkedIn. She says, it's true, using grades to control the student behavior and participation in class, it's kind of universal. I think that is something that we've seen around the world. Doesn't matter the language or the system. What are the wins, Star, from allowing our students to co-construct success criteria? Walk us through what this might look like in a learning activity.
So this could look a lot of different ways, but I think when we're co-constructing with students, this is just another way to give them ownership in the process so that they really understand what it means to be successful before they start. So often, and again, guilty of this in my early career, even when you use a rubric, if you're not providing benchmarks and touchstones for them to understand exactly what it looks like, multiple models and exemplars, as well as giving them a chance to weigh in on what they think it means to be successful, then we're missing an opportunity to make sure they're clear before they start. And student clarity is of the utmost importance when we think about learning. And it's often one of those things that we don't give credence to until we get their work back and we realize they didn't understand what we were asking them to do. And then what are we most likely to do? Blame them for it. And really, it's a teacher clarity issue. If I wasn't clear about what I expected you to do, how is it fair that I'm expecting you to give me what I think if I didn't even clearly communicate that in a way that they're able to follow? And I learned that the hard way too. You give a project that you're super excited about, and then you get 20 versions from, 30 different kids. The 10 that did it the way you expected, the only reason they did was because they came for extra help and they didn't understand. And the other folks just thought they knew and went with it. And then, you're looking at the rubric, you're looking at what they submitted, and how could you even assess them accurately if what they turned in isn't what you expected?
Star, we're coming up on 1 year of the Learner-Centered Spaces podcast, which you co-host. Can you share about one of the more impactful guests or learning themes that you've enjoyed so far on that podcast?
So one of the things I love about working with Crystal on that podcast, Crystal Frommert, who's an amazing educator, is that we always talk about different learner-centered modalities for that podcast. Like we have, like you do, set questions that we normally ask, but it's super casual. And so if somebody says something really interesting, we're going to ditch all the questions we had and we're just going to follow their line of thinking. We've had so many awesome guests. Rick Wormley was one of our first guests, Evan Robb, Laura Robb, Ken O'Connor, recently Tyler Rablin, really so many folks, that Angela Stockman. And all of those conversations, although centered around learner-centered spaces, all took very different directions in terms of like focused on the content area. Crystal's got a background in math, so we get a lot of math educators doing really amazing stuff. And, I kind of bring in the more humanities-based folks or leadership folks who are really passionate about this work too. Like we recently had Katie Martin, who also does learner-centered work. So always having other people that we respect on the podcast is like a really awesome opportunity to just hear more about their experience and how they got to where they are.
So great. Again, that was the Learner-Centered Spaces podcast. So if you are listening on the audio-only version of Teachers on Fire, make sure you check out Learner-Centered Spaces. Thank you so much, Star. And I want to congratulate you on another title. And this one gets me sort of excited for different reasons, I suppose. Let's throw that image back on the screen if we can. And let's see if I can get rid of my text. There we go. So it's the one on the far right, Making an Impact Outside of the Classroom, a complete guide to the exciting job possibilities for educators. So I don't know if this is exactly where you are going with this book, but I wonder for the veteran teacher who still has the fire burning for education, they love what they do, but maybe the physical demands, the toll of the job is starting to catch up a little bit. What other possibilities are there? Are you saying there's something else that that they can pursue in education?
Absolutely. It's not just education. It's stuff all over. Like, I mean, the premise really was post-COVID, you see this exodus of people looking to leave education for a variety of reasons. And when you ask a person what they do for a living and they're like, I'm just a teacher, I don't believe any educator is just a teacher. Being a teacher is by far the most challenging and rewarding job there is. And so what I wanted to do is celebrate the unique skill set that teachers really have and show them that if you need a break from the classroom and you have these amazing skills that you've developed over the years, you are still very marketable in a lot of different ways. You could keep your foot in education without having to be in the classroom. So there are school-based opportunities, like there's a chapter on like ed tech and instructional technology jobs and different levels of that, leadership if you want to go up the ladder in a school system. But then there's also like I had the opportunity to interview a lot of folks who left the classroom. And that was maybe my favorite part of this process with this book, really working on my own journalism skills after being a journalism teacher. And with this book, there's actually going to be a playlist of all of those videoed interviews. So as you're reading, if you want to learn more about one of the different jobs that somebody has done, you're able to watch that conversation and really learn about what these different jobs look like, feel like, sound like, and how being in the classroom uniquely prepared them to do it. And so like this, it's just this idea of celebration that even if we step away from the classroom for any period of time, the opportunity to go back is always there. And honestly, like I've been out of the classroom now since 2017, 16 or 17. And the only thing that keeps me going is the idea that I might wind up back in a classroom one day. Mm. Awesome. It was by far the most rewarding work, working with kids. And I miss it all the time. So that's also why the job embedded part of my consulting work is really important to me. I want to be in classrooms. I want to be around kids because that's who the work is about.
I love that idea that you're only 1 year or a few months away from getting back into the classroom really at any time. I heard mm-hmm. recently you started out by talking about just the toll or the challenge of the job. And I heard recently that public speaking is the equivalent of doing an 8-hour shift. So giving 1 hour long speech is the equivalent of doing an 8-hour shift, I suppose, in some sort of office or cubicle role of some kind. And I thought, where does that leave teachers, right? Who are at the front of a classroom. And I know it's different work, not quite the same, but you do hear your name maybe called out about 200 times in a day for those primary teachers. So there's definitely a toll to consider there. Teachers, if you're enjoying this conversation, consider adding the Teachers on Fire YouTube channel to your morning commute. Start your day on fire. Star, we're starting to transition toward the end of this conversation. I'm curious, outside of education, what's another area of learning for you? What is it that ignites your passions away from education and brings you alive as a human being?
So there's so much. Like, I would say post-COVID that aside from really spending time learning more about my own implicit biases and learning more about how to get involved in a lot of social equity kind of conversations, I'm also kind of a history buff. So I spend a lot of time, like during COVID, I did this thing where I started listening to biographies of all the founding fathers. So seeing specific historical events through the eyes of different people who lived it and just trying to understand the full concept of the historical moment through these different people, through the biographies of these different people. And then I was like, you know, it would have been really cool for me to be a historian to kind of go through things that way. And then right now I'm listening to a book about Sylvia Plath, which kind of goes beyond this mythology of her and her mental health and all the things that kind of brought her together, and really shines a light on just her not necessarily having those issues, but society being challenged by a woman who was way ahead of her time. And I could really connect with a lot of things she experienced as a writer, just thinking about the dry spells and what you do to yourself when you're trying to think about those different things and how emotionally and mentally it really takes a toll when you're trying to do something and people have come to expect it of you. When you hit a dry spell, there's nothing worse. During COVID, I did write Assessing with Respect during COVID, and it was the hardest book I ever wrote, just because I couldn't get in the right headspace. And I was so worried that maybe this gift that I had somehow dried up and that the opportunity to really connect with my writing again wasn't going to come back. And it was so scary for a little bit.
Wow. You mentioned the Founding Fathers. I was going to say most of what I know about the Founding Fathers comes from Hamilton. I know, I'm sure you've seen that once or twice. Share about a personal habit or productivity hack. And you're one of these high functioning, maybe there's another side that you could tell us about, but you do so much. So is there a personal habit or a productivity hack that contributes to your success and keeps your fire burning, and even when things are crazy busy like today?
Sure. So I am a habitual early riser. Like, I am up before dawn, 4 o'clock usually, because taking care of myself physically is really important. The older I get, obviously the body doesn't respond the same way it did when I was in my 20s and 30s. So like thinking about just making sure I take time for exercise. I usually work out in the morning, and then if I'm home doing Zoom calls all day, like all day long, I will make sure that I schedule time in to take walks, get out of the house, get away from the computer, even if it's just a mile for like 15 minutes with an easy walk in between to get some sunshine and like get out of my head, listen to music, listen to a book, listen to nature. If I could get to a park instead of just walking around my neighborhood. So like, that's my productivity hack. Sometimes we force ourselves to work through because we have deadlines. And it's been my experience that sometimes a break is more effective than trying to get it all done, because the quality of the work when you're trying to get it all done is just not as good. And as somebody who's I know my writing process, and I think that with writing in particular, or planning for a presentation or all of these things, if I'm not in the right headspace, my best work's not going to happen. So taking breaks, brain breaks, that's my productivity hack.
That's a separate conversation, getting into Star's writing process. I'd be really interested to hear more about that. Well, we're getting even faster here. So whatever comes to mind on these questions, Star, first one, when it comes to Education X, formerly Teacher Twitter, tell us about someone we should follow there and share why they've been inspiring you lately.
Okay, so Twitter is challenging. I've been on it a lot less since it's become X. But I have, you know, my EdChamp brothers and sisters are probably the folks. It's an ASCD group of middle career folks who do great things. And right now on LinkedIn, Marnie Hazelton, who's a superintendent, does tremendous things. She's really worth following because of the inspiring work she does.
Recommend one book, one that you've been reading lately, or one of your all-time faves.
Okay, that's hard. I would say that two come to mind as far as like really practical reads: Connie Hamilton's Hacking Group Work and also Hacking Questions. Everything engagement you need are in those books. And Connie is just one of the smartest people I know.
She is awesome. That's really neat that you've connected with her. I mean, she's sort of built her work around math mostly, right? I wanted to be sure I have that straight. On the subject of podcasts and as a support to my work, Star, who's one educator or speaker that you would recommend I interview next on the Teachers on Fire podcast?
Well, if you haven't had Connie on yet, I would say her. But otherwise, who I'm trying to think in my group, maybe Tiffany Hall. Okay. Or Alexandra Lange. They're some of the folks that I work with right now. We're actually working on a book together, and both of them are brilliant. Marianne DeRosa, but she probably won't come on a podcast. So.
And just for fun, now this may not go very well with those 4 a.m. wake up times, but just for fun, what are you streaming these days on your downtime?
Oh, God. There's so many fun things. I'm going to be embarrassed to say what I watch, because when I don't want to be very intellectual, I like Love is Blind.
Sure. Okay. Well, you're the second straight guest to point to that one. So you're clearly not the only one. So no apologies.
Another crazy thing to watch, honestly. It's like a train wreck, but you just can't stop watching.
Hey, we need some of those sometimes. Star, thank you so much for this. What are the best ways for the Teachers on Fire listening to follow you and connect with your work?
Sure. So I would say LinkedIn's probably where I am the most right now. Star Saxteen on there. I have a website, MissSaxteen.com, and also our company website, MasteryPortfolio.com. That's usually where you could find me and all of the new upcoming events, new books, all the things are on there. I am still on Twitter. I refuse to call it X. I'm still on there, but not as much. And I've started taking Facebook back, getting rid of extraneous folks. So if you happen to be somebody who has recently been unfriended, I apologize. I'm really trying to make it about family and friends so that I have one space that's not necessarily professional.
Well, I've been really upset about that. So thank you for bringing that up, Star. No, I get it. Absolutely. We're trying to carve out Facebook as more of a personal space. Well, thank you for joining this broadcast, Teachers on Fire. Please support the podcast by liking the video, or if you are listening on the audio-only version, subscribing. Just before I sign off, I want to throw up Star's books on the screen one more time. We've got, and there she's got other titles out there, but Student-Led Assessment is the one that is newest on the Amazon or the other book seller shelves. So Student-Led Assessment, Promoting Agency and Achievement Through Portfolios and Conferences. Of course, one of the classics right there in the middle, Hacking Assessment, 10 Ways to Go Gradeless in a Traditional Grade School. And coming up, a book we're looking forward to, Making an Impact Outside of the Classroom, A Complete Guide to the Exciting Job Possibilities for Educators. So there's a lot there. Thank you so much. And I have to say, this episode is not sponsored, but I'm really just a big fan of Star's work. Thank you again, Star, for on a busy day taking some minutes out to chat with me. I really appreciate it. Mm-hmm. Teachers on Fire, I'm your host, Tim Cavey, and I'm so grateful that you decided to spend some of your day tuning into this podcast. If you enjoyed the content you heard today from Star, make sure to connect with her at MS Saxine on X, or as you just heard, better yet, on LinkedIn, or at her website, mssaxine.com. Star, thank you again so much, and take care. I hope you have a great day, and the workshop, the book signing, everything else you're doing there, I hope that goes really well for you.
Thanks so much, Tim.
Bye-bye, everyone. When you feel low, you can still go. Even when you feel slow, you can still go. Even when there's no hope, you can still go. I never answer to no, man, I still go.